Case number 22-1076, Fontam U.S. LLC petitioner versus United States Food and Drug Administration. Mr. Prince for the petitioner, Mr. Coyle for the respondent.
Good morning, Mr. Prince. Are we ready?
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you, and may it please the court. FDA denied Fontam's e-cigarette applications in this case for an alleged failure to satisfy the Tobacco Control Act's appropriate for the protection of public health standard. But FDA notably never concluded that Fontam's products pose any actual public health problem, notwithstanding that Fontam's tobacco-flavored product had been on the market for many years. Instead, they denied the application for alleged data gaps. But those data gaps were solely the result of FDA's flawed review. Before getting to the merits, though, I would like to briefly address the elephant in the room, which is the effect of the court's or FDA's denial of supervisory review late breaking last Friday. We filed a new petition for review on Monday, which the court graciously acted on quickly and consolidated with our original petition for review. We apologize for the last minute filings, of course, but it was done out of necessity. But the upshot of that flurry of activity is my understanding is the parties now agree that the prematurity concerns raised by the government in its response brief are resolved. And that is consistent with this court's past precedents in Bahamas County and Columbia Falls Aluminum, where a very similar situation arose and the court consolidated to resolve any prematurity concerns. As to the impact of the supervisory
Mr. Prince, you don't concede that there was a prematurity problem with your first petition, do you?
We do not, Your Honor. We stand by the arguments we raised in our reply brief. Having now done a very deep dive on these cases, I think a very interesting law review article could be written about the interaction of the incurably premature doctrine, the Supreme Court's recent repeated cautioning not to read jurisdictional requirements into the statute where Congress has not put them in there, and this court's recent clarification that finality in many cases, in fact, non-jurisdictional. But I don't think the court needs to address that in this case, because either we're right or the government's right. So this court has jurisdiction to review the marketing denial order. And in fact, a very similar situation came up in a case I'll provide, which we haven't provided to you yet. It's Collins v. National Transportation Safety Board, 351 F3rd 1246. From 2003, where the court was faced with competing petitions for review in an incurably premature situation. And it said, we just don't even need to decide this because either way we have jurisdiction and we would submit the same.
It does seem that it would be helpful to have a rule though for other companies in a similar position with the FDA. Maybe that's not your concern. But
I don't dispute that, and protective petitions are filed in the circumstance frequently because I think the law is fairly unclear on it. But again, it is a fairly complicated issue and requires resolving a bunch of kind of late-breaking principles of law. So I would submit you don't need to do it in this case. As to the impact of the supervisory review denial itself, in Fontam's view, it has no impact on this court's review of the merits. Under the Supreme Court's decision in Locomotive Engineers, whereas here a request to the agency, if it can be considered reconsideration, was focused on error in the underlying order, the agency's order denying that request is unreviewable unless the agency's formal disposition is to modify the order. And that's true, the Supreme Court said, and this court has also said, even if the order refusing reconsideration discusses the merits of the claims at length. Here, all the agency did was decline to disturb its underlying order. The supervisor said, I concur with the decision to issue the MDOs and thus deny your argument. So there was no reopening and issuing a new order in this case. It's unreviewable. Turning to the merits of the marketing denial order that actually is at issue in this case, I'd like to start, unless the court has a different preference, with our structural arguments, which we believe caused FDA to simply misapply the statute. Simply put, FDA has ignored all of the advance notice requirements that Congress put in place in the statute. Congress specifically set forth in 387JC the four criteria that FDA is to consider when evaluating an application including whether the product is appropriate for the protection of the public health, and including whether it complies with manufacturing standards the FDA is obligated under the statute to promulgate. The delineation is important because Congress directed that specific problems be addressed in very specific ways, and the manufacturing prong is especially relevant here because I think it's undisputed in this case that FDA denied our application for manufacturing reasons. I mean, deficiency 2, deficiency 6, these are like literally in the heartland of what would normally be put in an FDA.
Can I give you an interpretation of the statute and you tell me why it's wrong? You look at A and it says the FDA can do individual adjudications where they balance and they figure out, is this product good enough for public health? Then B and D in particular allow the FDA to promulgate rules using notice and comment with regard to manufacturing and tobacco product standards. And the benefit of doing that to FDA is that when there is an adjudication, which is going to focus on the balancing in A, FDA won't even have to give an explanation if the tobacco product has violated one of the rules promulgated under B and D. So the FDA can do it one of two ways. They can either do it all under A and explain themselves, or they can promulgate under B and D, and then if B and D's rules are violated, when they apply A, all they have to say is, you didn't follow the rule that we promulgated under B and D.
I hear that, Your Honor. I have a few responses. One is there's always overlap between the prongs in these cases. In Justice Scalia's opinion in RAD LAX, for example, there was undoubtedly overlap between the prongs. And what the court said is, look, when there's overlap and one of the provisions is very specific and Congress has sort of gone out of its way to articulate a specific process, that needs to be honored. Here, the manufacturing provision in particular, it makes eminent sense that Congress would want manufacturers to have advance notice of things like what they need to test and what documentation they need. That's why we have such the lack of that is why we have such a fundamentally broken FDA review process. But it would be very odd for Congress to have said, okay, you must promulgate these manufacturing standards. By the way, you need to consult with technical experts when you do it. You need to give manufacturers grace periods to comply. All of these are to benefit manufacturers, not FDA. So I don't think the provision can be read as, you know, essentially conferring on FDA discretion to do what it thinks it's best, right? It's avoiding procedural rights that manufacturers.
So, Council, let me try a simpler proposition. What, if anything, tell me, what does anything does the FDA say about the methods used in or the facilities or controls used for the manufacturer, et cetera?
What does it say that means, or what is it?
No, what in their decision did they say? You're saying they rested on that inappropriately rested on B considerations when rendering a decision under A, right? What did they say about B considerations?
So a lot of the for example, many of the deficiencies are based on the methods and the documentation we have to map out our product characteristics, the testing against those product characteristics. For example, you know, environmental controls, the humidity in storage rooms. This is all within the heartland of manufacturing regulations.
But it seems to me they faulted you time and time again for failing to produce something that they wanted or maybe newly discovered that they wanted.
I think that
not
is...
Not for failure to comply with anything in B, but for failure to file information on which they could make a decision relating to B.
What B is intended to do is set out the processes and procedures that you need to follow to get to a position where FDA can make a decision. I would point your honors to the medical device context in the same statute, which is what Congress modeled this on. And there FDA has hundreds of pages in the Federal Register describing what you need to do. You need to keep controls for environmental control. You need to do various sort of processes and procedures for stability issues. That's like we are supposed to know to do that so that FDA can then reach a decision based on the data that we know we have to collect. And I don't even read FDA's brief, by the way, to be opposing our views that, for example, deficiency 2 could be considered under B. And I think FDA's argument is different. I think they've conceded it. I think FDA's argument is different. Their argument, as I understand it, is notwithstanding the overlap, we're allowed to do it under the public health prong as long as it raises some conceivable public health issue. But there's two problems with that. The first problem is that manufacturing standards Congress put right in the statute also address public health issues. So there's a much more specific solution as to manufacturing for public health issues that Congress has told FDA to use. And again, I mean, it's to me, this case is indistinguishable from RAD-LAX. There's an overlap. The agency would prefer to use one criteria, but the other criteria is more specific.
I think you're correct about the agency's view of the relationship between B and A. Whether you agree with it or a different matter, that I think is the position. Correct. That's the position they've taken. It may be that the straightforward reading makes it even easier than that.
Oh, I was just going to say that then if that is the agency's view, I submit that they have misapplied the law and the orders need to be vacated for the agency to apply the correct legal standard. And if it thinks some of these on reflection are not actually manufacturing issues, it's obligated under the APA to clearly explain why.
Mr. Prince, I think one of the, I'm sympathetic to your argument that, you know, there are these four different reasons that they can deny the approval of an application. And so you can't necessarily put, you know, one of these prongs into another one. But I think one of the difficult things about this statute is the approval authority allows FDA to require applications to have fairly specific content, right? To provide information on a whole host of different subjects. And so I think you need to have some account of how that content maps onto the requirement to have tobacco product standards or manufacturing standards. I think that that interrelationship is very important to understand.
I think so too, and I think it's not a perfect overlap, but I think the application criteria, which Congress does spell out, actually map on pretty closely to the denial grounds. There's, I believe, one that maybe could fit into multiple categories, but otherwise, it's like literally using the same language, right? Submit information about the methods and controls for manufacturing. And then there's a separate version of the statute that says, okay, FDA, you can deny it when the methods and controls don't conform to your manufacturing regulations. FDA did point to that relationship in their brief, but I just don't think it works. And it's creating superfluidity, as Justice Scalia said.
Well, so if they don't do standards, and yet their applications include things about, say, the methods and content of these products, how are they supposed to evaluate the things that are required in the application in the absence of standards?
Well, I don't think they can do that consistent with the statute. I think if they're going to deny an application for manufacturing issues, things that would fall within B, they need to first promulgate a standard, because by definition, the statute says the ground for denial is a failure to comply with the regulation. The product standards argument is admittedly a little bit more difficult for us because that authority is phrased in more permissive terms. But let's suppose there is no statutory violation. Disagree with us on the statutory violation. FDA still would need to give very clear, as this court has said, reasonably certain to a good faith regulated entity, notice of what the manufacturing requirements are. And we submit to not have reasonably certain notice of any of these requirements. And if you disagree with us on that, I would just invite the court to compare the high level of generality of the deficiency letter, which is frankly difficult for me to even understand in parts, with the clarity of the rejection letter, where FDA is imposing very specific requirements for very specific kinds of testing, telling us exactly, you know, the kind of data we would need in many circumstances.
So, Prince, how does it work in practice? I mean, the FDA says that a manufacturer can file as many amendments as it chooses to an application in order to comply with a deficiency letter. So how does that work in practice before the ultimate denial?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think it helps to help to take a step back and look at the other regulatory regimes that FDA is implementing, because they work very similar, where FDA is applying what is admittedly a broad statutory standard. And normally you're having meetings with the agency. There are many, many rounds of these kind of deficiency letters. The agency publishes product-specific drug guidance, device guidance. These are the type of environmental controls you need. So the regulated entities sort of know what they're aiming at. And then you're meeting with the agency throughout the year-long process. You know, is this study design acceptable? Is it not? And, you know, I submit here that FDA, you know, basically implemented for tobacco a regulatory regime without doing any of the prerequisite work to put in place a regulatory regime, but nonetheless, that's what it did. And the solution is that FDA needs to do the same kind of iterative process to make sure that regulated entities are getting fair notice. You know, really all we needed here was the opportunity to respond to the rejection letter. And we could have resolved the vast majority of these things. It's just information that, you know, you didn't provide this one data point and we need it. That's all we needed to do.
So what about, I'd like to talk about deficiency five, about the flavored products. So with respect to deficiency five, I mean, the reasoning that the FDA gives for that deficiency is very similar to the type of reasoning that this court approved in Prohibition Juice last summer. And so I'm wondering how your challenge to deficiency five, how would you distinguish that from the type of reasoning that this court upheld in Prohibition Juice?
I actually think Prohibition Juice is a nice comparison because the standard the FDA reported to be applying there was different than the one it's purporting to apply here, which kind of shows the shifting standards and the lack of notice. But Prohibition Juice was fundamentally about whether FDA is allowed to do the sort of comparative comparison. Do you have to show not only that your product has a health benefit, but that it has a health benefit over tobacco? We're not disputing sort of that aspect of it, and we submitted longitudinal studies, unlike the Prohibition Juice folks, which we think demonstrate that. But here, FDA is sort of doing, it's a different kind of challenge. Our challenge here is grounded in cases like Pearson and City of Vernon, which the agency has set up a standard where it wants something quantitative in like the numerator, right? What is your benefits to adults? But the denominator is significant risk to youth, which nobody knows what it means. It's impossible to actually do like any comparison to tell whether you overcome the significant risk to youth because it means whatever the agency wants it to mean. And this order seems to say, you can't do the comparison yourself, but we know the only thing that will overcome it is a device access restriction, which nothing in the history of the tobacco control regulation has ever been required. And FDA admits is novel and rare in this record. The agency can't just have a standard that is, I know it when I see it. This court's held that squarely, and we submit that's effectively what they've imposed in deficiency five. I see I'm over time.
I've got a couple questions. If I can direct you to deficiency four without saying anything that's under seal, what would you say to this argument? If you're going to use data from a previous product or new product, you have to tell the FDA why every new aspect of the new product is immaterial. And with regard to one aspect of the new product, you did it.
So we understood the request to be to justify the product changes that we sort of reasonably thought could lead to a problem. And that's what we did to the agency. The agency knew about that one specific product design that you're talking about. It didn't specifically ask us a question about it. We personally did not think it was, the company did not think it personally was relevant, and so it didn't address it. I'm just gonna say, But it's fine if the agency is concerned about that. All it needed to do is ask us a specific question about it, and we would have told the agency.
Right, and I'm pretty sympathetic to the last thing that you said. If I were running the agency, I have no doubt I would have done that. But the question is whether APA and the statute here require it, and what they said in the deficiency letter is provide evidence to show that the changes do not matter. change is plural. And you didn't address every change.
All I can say, Your Honor, is we addressed the changes that we thought we were relevant. And
what would you say to the argument that they didn't ask you to address the changes you thought were relevant? They asked you to address all the changes.
I would say the agency needs to speak so that we know with reasonable certainty what the requirement is. And that's not what we took that that's not what we took the requirement to mean. I would also say, Your Honor, that deficiency alone is not a sufficient grounds to support these marketing denials.
So that's my last question. Assume I'm with the FDA on the merits of deficiency 4, and I'm not with them on anything else. Tell me why deficiency 4 isn't enough for us to deny your petition.
Because the agency has not purported to claim that's an independent ground for 1. Again, it needs to speak with, I think, with reasonable ascertainability that's what it was intended to do, and that's not what the decision maker did here. It's also just fundamentally inconsistent with the test that the agency purports to be applying when it's doing a public health analysis, which is to weigh all the risks and the benefits contained in the application. And these are just statements FDA's. Consider the application as a whole. FDA declines to assign specific weight to any evidence. So if mere uncertainty about that one product characteristic, which, by the way, FDA never actually says is likely to happen. They just say, oh, we don't know. It's a little unclear. They would have to say and explain why that outweighs all of the numerous benefits that our products have that are stated elsewhere in the record, and it hasn't done that. I'll also note, Your Honor, that I think deficiency 4, at least in terms of what we're required to do to manage product changes and document and test against, would also typically be considered a manufacturing regulation issue under FDA's other regulatory.
You said one thing toward the beginning there where you said the FDA never said this was an independent ground, but they said would be needed. They said this is needed.
Would be needed to resolve the deficiency. I do not read them to be saying that the deficiency itself is an independent ground. And we are not saying, by the way, that FDA, it's inconceivable that FDA could ever have an order where there are multiple, if your product blows up in somebody's face, the FDA could clearly say, like, yes, this deficiency alone is so serious that it outweighs any possible benefit. But, uncertainty about a tiny little thing that changed in our product, it's a real stretch that the decision maker would have concluded.
So as a court, are we supposed to sort through that if we think some deficiencies are reasonable and supported by the statute and some are not? I mean, how do we decide?
I don't think that's your role, just in generally under normal administrative law, but also in particular where the agency is applying a balancing test. That comes up in all sorts of other areas of the law, sentencing issues. I mean, if the agency has misconstrued the statute, if it's applied factors Congress didn't want it to consider, it needs to go back to the agency to redo.
Do you think that the denial letter contains at least a separate distinction between the flavored products and tobacco flavored products?
I do, and I think the agency's best arguments for independent ground would be on deficiency 5, in part because they could say, hey, we looked at this. We rejected it in prohibition juice. Why wouldn't we reject it here? So that's FDA's strongest argument. I would submit that FDA has said you need to conduct a product-specific balancing of the risks and the benefits, and our record of benefits is not the same as in prohibition.
Counsel, a moment ago you referred to the many benefits shown in the record. Remind me just briefly, what are you referring to?
The major benefit is the significant reduction in harmful and potentially harmful compounds relative to combusted cigarettes, which is sort of the gold standard.
Doesn't that depend upon switching smokers from combustible to vaping?
Yes, I suppose there does.
Okay, and the agency said that's not documented in a sufficient way to amount to anything. So your offhand references to all these benefits is one of the very things being disputed.
I don't agree that the agency said that, Your Honor. I think they said specifically with regard to flavored products, we hadn't demonstrated sufficient switching effects.
Well, they certainly said that, and they did not say something comparable, you're telling me, with regard to non-flavored?
I do not believe so.
I think that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. We'll give you some time on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, Mr. Coyle.
Good morning. May it please the court, Eric Coyle for the government. For six independent reasons, FDA reasonably determined that Fontam didn't meet the statutory public health standard to market its e-cigarettes, many of which come in fruit and dessert flavors attractive to kids. As FDA explained, despite the deficiency letter and the industry guidance, Fontam provided inadequate information about its product's health risks. This included information about emissions of substances like lead, formaldehyde, and nicotine, the risk of burn injuries, and the level of toxins and bacteria in the products over their shelf life. Before jumping to the merits, I would like to briefly address the effect of the decision on the supervisory review request. We've requested the opportunity to provide supplemental briefing on that issue. We got the other side's 28-J letter on Monday evening, and so we would request the opportunity to provide the court with additional briefing. We do think that decision is properly before the court and can be considered at this stage.
What would be the point of the supplemental?
To explain what the effects of that decision are on the issue before the court.
Are there any?
Yes, we do think there are. We think
other than the finality question?
Yes, besides the finality question, for example, the questions about whether the grounds are independent. There are seven, I believe, separate pieces of support for that in the supplemental decision. We think it was clear from the original decision, but there's any doubt would be eliminated with the supplemental decision. There are also some additional arguments that they have made, for example, in their letter earlier this month referencing the Office of Special Counsel findings to see how FDA passed on that. That would require the court to consider the supplemental decision.
So how would it work if the first denial letter was incurably premature? I mean, how would this work in practice? I mean, the statute says that a party has 30 days to seek judicial review from the denial of an application. And then, so in this case, you know, the Fontam sought, you know, filed a petition for review within 30 days, and then it sought an administrative appeal after that 30 days, right? So how does this work? I mean, would the 30-day timing for seeking a denial of an application be told if there was an administrative appeal pending? Is there some time limit for filing an appeal? I mean, the FDA's process is entirely informal. Perhaps there's some guidance indicating some timelines for filing an appeal. We were unable to locate any. I mean, just how would this work in practice? I mean, if you could just toll indefinitely, then the 30-day timeline in the statute would become irrelevant for filing a petition from the original denial.
I'd like to preface my answer by saying I don't think the court needs to decide that in this case. I think, you know, we've agreed the new petition is properly presented here.
Right, but your position is that the first petition was incurably premature, and I presume the agency may take that position in later cases. And so I just want to understand how the agency thinks this would work, given that the appeal process is not based in the statute. I'm not aware of any source of regulatory or even guidance that sets out the appeal process. I mean, how do those two things how does the appeal process interact with judicial review, which is clearly specified in the statute?
By analogy to the Hobbs Act, a filing of a petition for reconsideration before the agency tolls the statutory time to come to court and file a petition for review. So we think that would also apply in this circumstance as well.
Would a person have to file the administrative appeal within 30 days? Could it be at any time after 30 days?
I think if the petition for the reconsideration request were filed after 30 days, and there were also not a petition for review in this court within the 30-day period, then there might be a timing problem with coming to court afterwards. It might depend on whether the decision on reconsideration resulted in a new denial order or simply, reaffirming the
decision. But your answer just sort of reveals all the uncertainties for regulated entities in pursuing any of these paths.
Which is why I think the court, this might not be the case that would be the best vehicle to decide that question.
Think of it this way, and tell me what you think. If the first petition is filed from an order that is apparently final, and then someone seeks reconsideration of that order, essentially making the first order non-final, we're waiting for the final order. Whatever the final order says, whether it addresses the merits or not, that would then be the final matter subject to a new petition, and the new petition would be adequate.
Yes, we agree.
Thank you.
How does that intersect, though, with the Supreme Court's ICC versus Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers case?
Again, we would like the opportunity to brief this. We just got this letter on Monday night, and I'm not prepared to concede today that Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers even applies to this circumstance. But even under Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, there is a distinction between a request for reconsideration that just rehashes the prior arguments and says the agency got it wrong. The denial of that is not typically subject to judicial review. And a petition for review that presents either new evidence or changed circumstances, the denial of which is subject to judicial review. And here, there are multiple examples of new evidence that FONTA presented in the agency reconsideration request, like the Office of Special Counsel report that just came out last month. That was never presented in the original one. That's something that the agency just had a chance to look at now. And so we do think even under locomotive engineers, that would be subject to review.
You're saying the record's different.
Exactly.
The first petition dealt with one record, the second petition with it somewhat different.
Correct.
Under your theory, what would stop the FDA from just sitting on the reconsideration request in order to preclude judicial review?
So two responses. First of all, there's no requirement that a petitioner seek reconsideration before FDA. And many manufacturers have come straight to the Court of Appeals without seeking reconsideration. And there's also no suggestion, no allegation that FDA was anything but diligent here in resolving the administrative appeal.
With respect, I think I interpret you to say nothing. Nothing would stop the FDA from sitting on the motion, on the reconsideration request in order to preclude judicial review.
I think the agency's, there's no, in the agency regulation, there's no time limit, for example, limiting the agency's ability to decide, you know, requiring it to decide within a particular time. But there's also nothing to prevent an applicant who is frustrated with the pace from withdrawing the application for supervisory review if they so choose to do so.
Well, we've had situations where, and this is typically after a remand, but it would be same idea. The agency doesn't do anything, and the party then seeks under the All Writs Act, an order imposing a deadline, an immediate deadline on the agency. And I think the cases will show that it takes about 18 months before we will agree that the agency has been too sluggish.
I'm not familiar with that. Again, we got this letter on Monday night. We would like the opportunity, if the court is interested in this, to present supplemental briefing on the issue. If I can turn to the merits, and based on where the questioning went earlier, I'd like to start with the statutory argument.
Well, I have a question about that. It's the same question that I was pursuing with your opposing counsel. What did the agency say to the effect that the methods or controls used for manufacturer, et cetera, do not conform to the requirements of 387FE.
So I don't believe that was the ground for the basis of the denial order here. The denial order here is
the agency said nothing about that, correct?
Correct. The agency determined that this application
said they didn't provide enough information for you to make a determination under A.
That's exactly right.
All right. Thank you.
I'd also point out that the Act requires FDA to adjudicate marketing applications. The Act says that FDA is to consider a broad range of information when doing so, including about the product's health risks and manufacturing processes. And the Act requires FDA to deny an application when the manufacturer doesn't make the required public health showing under the appropriate for the protection of the public health prong.
So Mr. Paul, maybe you can speak to that. What is the relationship between the content that's required on the application and how the FDA measures whether it's appropriate for the protection of public health, right? So in a situation where the FDA has not promulgated tobacco product standards and has not promulgated manufacturing standards, what do they do with this information on the application? I mean, what is it fair to ask manufacturers to demonstrate in these applications in the absence of any notice about what the standards are?
The statute itself puts the burden on manufacturers to make the showing that their products are appropriate for the protection of the public health, meaning the benefits outweigh the risks, considering the risks and benefits to the population as a whole. And the agency has, in this case, explained how each of the shortcomings in Fontam's application affect the public health in the end of the day. The emission of substances like lead, formaldehyde, nicotine.
Those are very granular things. So the statute for the adequate for the protection of public health sets out this risk-benefit analysis standard. But it also suggests that there are other prongs for denial where an application fails to meet a manufacturing standard or a tobacco product standard. So I guess I'm not sure why FDA thinks that it can effectively impose those standards under the broader public health umbrella.
So the agency is not imposing those standards under the broader public health umbrella. We agree with Judge Walker's questions earlier that manufacturing requirements and product standards, you know, potentially allow FDA to deny an application solely for that ground, irrespective of the effects of that particular product on the public health. They're two separate prongs of the statute that FDA analyzes.
Well, they are two separate prongs, but I mean, the statute is very specific. I mean, it doesn't seem, I mean, I know FDA denies that they're in fact doing this, but if they, through the public health prong, say you haven't met a certain standard of emissions or, you know, other controls, I don't want to mention any of the sealed material, you know, at what point can they do that just under the general public health prong as opposed to through the notice that's required by promulgating a standard? I mean, the statute is very granular in what it requires for FDA rulemaking. You know, there are very specific requirements for the type of notice that must be given, for the length of comment periods, for consultation with, you know, the expert advisory committee, for delayed effective dates of standards. And I mean, that is very specific guidance from Congress about what FDA is supposed to do. So it does seem difficult then to impose those standards effectively through the public health prompt.
The two responses, first one about the specific denial here and then about the effect of the statute more generally. The shortcomings here were that Fontam didn't provide adequate information about its product's health risks to allow FDA to make the ultimate public health finding under the statute.
But that information is being judged against some type of implicit standard that FDA is considering, right? You're saying the information is inadequate for us to evaluate against some standard, a standard that has not been stated in advance through rulemaking that Congress required.
It is not here. The defects here were not that the application failed to show that the products met a particular manufacturing requirement or product standard. For example, the microbial stability data didn't exceed a certain level. That was not what the deficiency was. The deficiency was Fontam didn't provide the required information so that FDA could evaluate it at all and conclude that the risks were not outweighed by the benefit.
Yeah, but that information goes to some specific way that the FDA is going to evaluate the benefits and risks. So you can say it's a failure of information, but it's failure of information to make a determination under some standard, right? I mean, because the information is not just information in general, it's information to evaluate something specific.
And the specific is the statutory requirement that the product be appropriate for the protection of the public health, considering the risks and benefits. And it was relevant to the product's risks, the product's health risks to its users. The other response, more generally, talking about the statute, this provision still had independent effect. And I'd point out that the pre-market adjudication process applies only to new tobacco products, that is, products that were not on the market in 2007. If FDA wants to impose a requirement on a product that's not a new tobacco product, like a cigarette that was on the market in 2007, then manufacturing requirements or product standards would be the way to do that. And then they're also just the focus of the two provisions is different. One is looking at the product-specific effects on the population as a whole. That's what adjudication is. Whereas the manufacturing requirements and product standards are looking at the effects of imposing a requirement on a broader class of tobacco.
So is there any limitation on what the FDA can consider under the public health prong? Is it just sort of anything it thinks may be relevant to the risks and benefits of these products?
I think the FDA has to explain how the particular information is relevant, and FDA did so here, talked about why the level of microbes, level of toxins and bacteria can change in a product over its shelf life and how those can cause cancer and respiratory problems, for example. So I think FDA has to connect it to the bottom line public health standard, but the statute itself tells FDA that there's a broad range of information that it should be considering in doing that.
Has FDA promulgated any tobacco product standards or manufacturing standards under the statute?
I believe there is I don't know the latest status, but there is a product standard that would prohibit menthol flavor in cigarettes. I don't know the status of that. The manufacturing requirement, there's a proposed rule on the unified agenda. It's been pending with OMB since May of last year. I don't know any more information than that.
So just two.
I don't know. There might be more product standards. I don't know. I don't know one way or the other.
Can I ask about, first I want to ask what the FDA meant in the order when it used the word need. So for example, it describes information about the temperature and humidity in the clean room as needed. Did the FDA mean that information is so essential that it will deny Quantum's request without it? Or did it mean that information would be maybe not essential, but really helpful to the FDA's consideration of Quantum's request?
I believe each deficiency on its own is independent. So all of the information under a particular deficiency would be needed in order to meet the standard is what FDA said here. I think you can also see that from the...
So Quantum says that if that's the case, that would be arbitrary and capricious in itself to say that just simply leaving out the temperature of clean room would justify denying Quantum's application.
That was not the sole basis of deficiency three. It was not just temperature and humidity data. It's the entirety of deficiency three is the independent ground. That included information about accreditation certificates for testing
labs. I'm following.
Okay.
And I think what you're saying is when the word needed was used with regard to the temperature in the control room, FDA didn't mean that information is needed in order for Quantum's application to be granted. It may be meant it was needed in order for deficiency three to be satisfied.
I don't think that's right. I think the marketing denial order itself says that information would be needed in a subsequent application, not that Quantum could make a stronger showing in other areas to overcome that.
Well, then now we're back to my question, which Quantum raises in its brief. Wouldn't it be arbitrary and capricious for the FDA to say that the information about temperature in the room is so important to us that it's essential, and we're gonna deny your application if you don't give it to us? Wouldn't that be arbitrary and capricious?
I don't think it necessarily would be, but that's not the question here. There's more to deficiency three. It includes...
Right. No, I know, but I'm making a hypothetical.
I don't think that would be
unreasonable?
Temperature and humidity can affect the growth of all sorts of substances like bacteria, fungi, mold, but that's not the sole basis. I would also point, Your Honor, to the technical project lead review. Pages 858 and 859, FDA explained that without each piece of information, FDA could not reach the bottom line public health conclusion.
Okay. Those are internal documents, right?
I think they can properly be considered for a couple of reasons. I point you to JA-816. This is the first page of the technical project lead memo. It's issued on the same date that the marketing denial order is. And at the bottom, the decision maker for the marketing denial order signs the technical project lead memorandum saying he concurs with the recommendation and the basis for the recommendation. So I think it's properly considered as part of the agency's decision here. It's not a post hoc rationalization. It was decided the same day as simultaneous with the marketing denial.
Counsel, are you familiar with the GMP regulations for drugs?
I'm not familiar, Your Honor. I apologize.
Assume that I agree with you about the merits of deficiency four. Assume I disagree with you about everything else. All the other deficiencies. What's your best argument for why we should agree with the FDA when it said deficiency four is alone enough to justify denying the application?
The two record places I would point you to are JA 858 and 859, where FDA explained that without the information in deficiency four, FDA could not conclude that the products were appropriate for the protection of the public health, which is the ultimate statutory requirement that FDA has to find before it can grant. And second, I point your honor to JA 880 to 83, which includes the would be needed language that your honor was.
And then if I could ask.
And then, oh, I'm sorry, one more. We also think that the decision on the supervisory review request makes this crystal clear. Pages 3, 4, 8, 9, 10, or not 8, 3, 4, 9, 10, 12, 17, and 23 and 24. I think seven separate places there. Yeah. It's clear that the grounds are in.
It's not surprising since that was done after this litigation. was precisely the issue that wasn't in the initial order, it's not surprising that.
But the agency considered the arguments there and said, you know what? We think you're wrong, but even if you were right, we would come to the same bottom line decision.
Let me ask about deficiency two on the merits. JA 617 is under seal. So I'm just going to talk about paragraph. I'm just going to say it's the second full paragraph.
The second full paragraph or the second?
The second full paragraph. It starts with although.
Okay.
Why isn't that good enough to justify that Fontam's tests reflect the use patterns of the puff?
There's a distinction between the length of puff and the number of puffs. The deficiency that FDA found was on the justification for the number of puffs used. The paragraph you're referring to is about puff duration.
But it looks like number of puffs. Oh, I see. I think I see. Okay. I'll take a look at it more closely, but fair enough. And then my last question is on footnote 3 in the denial letter, which is public. And then it's JA 475. And Fontam makes this argument pretty clearly in its briefing. It says, here you are and just categorically imposing a requirement for device access restrictions when it comes to flavored e-cigarettes. And you can't just impose a categorical rule like that when, absent notice of comment, when you say you're doing a balancing test and you never told us about this categorical rule before. And so do you agree with Fontam that you are imposing an absolute requirement for flavored e-cigs to have device access restrictions?
No, we do not.
So why does footnote 3 not say that?
So we're talking solely on the risk side of the equation here. This is a risk-benefit balancing test, and we're only looking at the risks to youth. And what FDA is saying is that it's got a lot of experience with the traditional sales access and marketing restrictions, like requiring somebody to show ID when they buy one of these products. And FDA's experience shows that that's not good enough to lower the risks, because people get these from friends. Kids get these from their friends, not from buying them at convenience stores. And so the risks are going to remain high if those traditional types of sales access and marketing restrictions are the only thing that's proposed. Now, there may be a way to lower those risks if you have device access restrictions, like requiring a fingerprint to unlock it the way you unlock your phone. But FDA considers those in each separate application, and FDA hasn't enacted a requirement to have those. But that's just the risk side. Then FDA takes a look at the benefits, to potential benefits to adult smokers, and says, if you've only got the traditional sales access and marketing restrictions, you're going to have a high risk, so you need to show an even higher benefit to adult smokers. And that's where FDA looked at the specific evidence here and identified the shortcomings of each study that Quantum submitted, the inadequate sample sizes, the mixed results, the lack of a showing that their products were going to be more beneficial to adult cigarette smokers than tobacco-flavored.
So would it be fair to say that unless Quantum can produce evidence that's never been produced before, that the benefit side is higher than we realized, that then Quantum has to do a device access restriction? Otherwise, the risk side is always going to outweigh.
FDA looks at each application individually. I don't think there is a blanket rule that would always require anything, or you know, other than that the benefits outweigh the risks.
But FDA has never approved a flavored application, a flavored e-cigarette product, okay?
That's correct. There are still flavored applications pending with FDA. FDA takes a look at each of them individually, looks at the risks on one side, the benefits on the other. I do believe that there are, attempts to provide the types of robust and reliable evidence on the benefit side, and FDA is still considering those in each instance. They're considering applications that present randomized controlled trials and longitudinal cohort studies. There was none here. There was a Quantum submitted a plan to conduct one of those types of studies and didn't provide any of the results or data from it. So FDA explained that that wasn't enough.
Does FDA explain, so its general course has been to proceed, as you said, individually through adjudicating these applications. I mean, Congress gave FDA the authority to regulate tobacco products, but arguably the Tobacco Control Act is a very detailed and comprehensive negotiated deal between protecting public health and the interests of manufacturers. And the interest of manufacturers is largely reflected in all of the rulemaking requirements that are imposed on FDA. So if all of these tobacco product concerns are adjudicated through the general public health prong, I'm just wondering how that is consistent with this very careful grant of authority that Congress gave to the FDA. I mean, I think it's just sort of like stepping back. You know, I've read through the whole act carefully, and I do think that this general approach is hard to square with what Congress did here very clearly and plainly in the Tobacco Control Act.
I think the two provisions have independent effect. I talked about the new tobacco product versus not. I also agree with Judge Walker's questions earlier, which indicated that if FDA does go that rulemaking route, then it can deny an application solely for the failure to satisfy the particular rule without respect to the product's effects on the public health separately. So there are two independent bases.
But that suggests that the rulemaking is just a convenience to FDA. But that's clearly not the only purpose of rulemaking. The primary purpose of rulemaking is to allow for public input, to provide notice, to provide some clear standards that entities can attempt to meet. I mean, that's the main purpose of notice and comment rulemaking.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It's not a convenience to the agency. It's for the public. and for private companies who are trying to market these products.
It certainly is, but once the rule has gone through that, then the failure to comply with that rule would be an independently sufficient reason to deny an application. The public health standard is a separate ground to deny an application. You have to, FDA has to consider the risks and benefits to the whole population that would come from marketing that particular product.
So your approach is to say, I guess, that the agency may proceed by adjudication rather than by regulation.
Not only may, the Act requires the agency to adjudicate marketing applications, and it requires the agency to deny an application if it doesn't make the public choice.
Well, that wouldn't work if the statute requires you to issue a regulation, which is what's being implied.
They're separate sources of authority. I think there is still the requirement that the agency adjudicate marketing application.
You say that they're separate, but they're also connected because some of the grounds for denial of an application turn on whether the application meets regulatory standards that the statute seems to assume FDA will promulgate. So, they are connected. And the language of the content of the applications is phrased in terms almost identical, or in many cases, in fact, identical to the statutory provisions requiring FDA to do tobacco product standards and manufacturing standards. So of course, FDA has the ability to adjudicate these applications, but that authority is very much connected in the statute, arguably, to the requirement for rulemaking.
There's certainly overlap, and that's because the way products are manufactured can have effects on the public health, on the health risks to users and the potential benefits. So there's certainly going to be some overlap, but we think the statute still requires FDA to decide these and to deny them when they don't make the bottom line statutory public health showing in the Act.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I thought I would start with the government's pointing out that the reconsideration or supervisory review denial addressed a memo from the special counsel's office regarding one of the letters under review. The Supreme Court in Locomotive Engineers said it's the formal disposition that matters of the agency order. You don't sort of read between the lines to see, was the agency, the Supreme Court said, quote, in fact, doing reconsideration, it's the formal disposition. But I would note that even if the agency did affect a sort of limited reopening for that limited purpose, it would still be a mixed order that is almost entirely denying reconsideration and addressing that one specific new issue. And under this court's precedence, I'd point you to USPS v. The Postal Regulatory Commission, 841 F3rd 509. The part that's addressing the record that was before the agency before remains unreviewable, even if that small little sliver is then subject to review, in that case, for abuse of discretion. We are not raising any challenge to the agency's consideration of the memo addressed in the special counsel. So I think it's just irrelevant to this case. I understand why the agency wants to get supervisory review denial in it, because there the agency actually did say that there are independent grounds for decision. But even taking that on its own terms, it's entirely unexplained. They just assert it. They assert it seven times, but they never explain why that would be an independent ground, why it would be independently sufficient to tip the balancing test that the agency, when it benefits the agency, purports to be applying in order to discount benefits, but if it sees a flaw, then all of a sudden, it's no longer balancing. I don't think the court should accept that rationale. Judge Walker, you were focused on deficiency four. Again, I submit that changes to product design should be set out in manufacturing regulations. So if you agree with us on that, I don't think you need to get to the issue that you were concerned about whether that one document purported to give us notice for public health prong purposes. And just in terms of the structural argument, Judge Rao, that you were talking to my friend on the other side about, and Judge Ginsburg, you raised this earlier. I do not hear the government to be walking away from the argument that it is free to pick and choose between the manufacturing prong and the public health prong. And the case law is abundantly clear, can't do that, in addition to RADLAX.
No, I don't think you said that. I think they're saying they're distinguishing between a violation of a manufacturing standard and a failure to provide information.
But Your Honor, the whole point of the manufacturing regulations is it's telling you the sort of information you need to collect. That is about processes and controls and requirements for documenting conditions, for documenting the specifications of your product and testing against them to see if they deviate. The medical device regulations are just replete with all of these kind of requirements, which the FDA flushes out on a product-specific basis with guidance. And so if FDA had put those regulations in place and had appropriate guidance, we would have known, for example, to monitor the humidity in various rooms in our manufacturing facility. But we didn't know until the denial. So I understand the government to be saying it can pick and choose, and this court's already made clear in Genus that FDA is not allowed to do that.
Is it part of your case that the government, pardon, that the FDA was required and failed to issue regulations?
Yes, I mean, if it was going to deny us for issues that properly fall within the manufacturing prong within B, it was required to promulgate regulations.
So should we remand this case until for them to issue their regulations?
You should vacate and remand this case, and if FDA...
For that purpose? So they can hold it until they get regulations out?
I think it is sufficient for you to vacate and remand this case saying that the agency applied the incorrect legal standard and considered factors that Congress did not allow it to consider. The agency on remand can then decide, do we want to try and deny quantum on manufacturing grounds again, in which case it couldn't do it until it issued a manufacturing regulation, or if it's claiming to you here that these other grounds were truly independent, it could try and deny us on those grounds with proper reasoning that we would then be able to challenge in court as arbitrary and capricious.
Take a couple of years to get regulations.
I will note that FDA has denied thousands of applications for e-cigarettes, and as far as I know, we are the only application where it purported to address these kind of manufacturing issues. So I don't think it's going to create a big problem in the sense that you might be worried about.
Is product design the same thing as the methods used in the manufacture, processing, or packing?
Yes, design controls are embedded within the manufacturing provision. And in fact, FDA specifically went to Congress to have the ability to impose design controls added to the medical device provision. So now those provisions overlap. But yes, the sort of things your product needs to be able to do, the specifications, how you test against it, are manufacturing.
This sounds more like a product standard.
I think there is some overlap between those, but FDA didn't do either here, so don't really have an opportunity. I mean, the FDA admittedly can try and distinguish, put some meat on the bones of those two things and flesh it out with a reasoned decision, but we just don't have that. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Prince. The case is submitted.